Thanks for staying up with us tonight, everyone. We're talking with Bill Chalker. Just heard the story of the Hair of the Alien case down there in Australia, and it's leading to interesting places with physical evidence to analyze. Bill, before we leave this part of the topic and open up the phone lines, I'm curious about the general abduction scenario in Australia. Is it pretty much the same that we hear about here in the States, both in the frequency and the nature of the cases?
Largely speaking, it is, and you know, you have that kind of consistent phenomenon, and I think that's what makes it so interesting as a phenomenon to study, and why I guess the work that we've been doing with these biochemists and other researchers is so interesting, is that it's presenting a bit of real science and applying that to a very controversial field, and perhaps lending a little bit of certainty or a little bit of understanding to what might be at the heart of all this, i.e. the nature of these alleged aliens that are intruding into our society, that they may have been visiting us for a long period of time, and that maybe they too have DNA, what might well in fact be a universal molecule out there. And this is one of the areas of controversy amongst biochemistry and research at the moment. One of the major evolutionary biologists out there, by the name of Simon Conway Morris, has published a book called Life Solutions, where the subtitle is Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe, where he argues that given the right opportunities on a habitable planet, humans ultimately will play out in pretty much the same way as we have here on Earth. And that's a fairly provocative and pretty revolutionary finding, to be coming from one of the leading biochemists in this area.
And is this a solvable mystery, do you think?
Well, I think that's part of the lesson with this strategy that I've been applying, is that we should be using science as our ally in this investigation. You know, the history of science in this UFO subject is so fraught with controversy and highly politicized and militarized science, where you've got the notorious Condon Report and that kind of thing. And yet if real science is applied to it, and I think that, you know, the book that you did with Cole Kellner, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, is a classic example of this. If you have the funding and the backup to do it, if you apply a bit of science and some heavy-duty data and equipment into controversial situations such as the Skinwalker Ranch, you can come up with some really interesting data.
You know, maybe, you know, this is just speculation, but maybe it's the journey, it's the process that's the that's important, as opposed to the ultimate answer.
Well, I'm enjoying the journey that I've been on for the last 10 years and prior to that as well. But it's I think we'll get to an answer on this, providing a lot of commitments involved as well. That's got to involve a fair bit of science as well.
One other question before we go to the phones. You know, the range of views on this alien abduction scenario range from you know, very light and breezy, we welcome our space brethren, they're here to help us, to very dark sort of things, that they're here to exploit us, we're their slaves, they're stealing our DNA, that kind of thing. Without asking you to contaminate your future research, where do you fall on that scale, or do you fall anywhere?
Well, the other aspect is outright complete rejection that none of this is happening. And,
sure.
and that's where I think the value of the work I've been doing is that it highlights the potential that some of this has really been happening. As to actually what's ultimately involved, I don't know. But certainly this investigation of this, what I refer to as an alien DNA paradigm, it suggests that whatever they're doing, they seem to have been doing it for quite some time, not only in terms of modern Western culture, with what we see and understand as the alien abduction phenomenon, but it also seems to be happening in historical times and also back thousands of years, which puts it into a whole new ball game, particularly if it's, you know, evidence of this might be confirmable courtesy of DNA through indigenous cultures, that kind of thing. So to me, it's a very promising area of investigation that really needs to be examined. You know.
So essentially, it looks like it is happening, but we don't know why.
Well, again, you know, you probably sense that I'm being a little cautious here.
I don't know.
Ultimately, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, of course. Yeah. Brian on our wildcard line he's trucking through Ohio. Brian, be careful driving out there.
Hello there, George and Mr. Cooper. I was just curious on your hair samples and that kind of stuff. Would you be interested in getting another hair sample?
I would, but with the I guess the caveat or the precaution that any investigation that we get into, because of the time, the cost, and the resources that we have to apply to these sorts of investigations, we do a pretty extensive workup in terms of investigating the, I guess, the chain of evidence, the credibility of the story, the whole background to it. So we need to do that because so much depends on that in terms of establishing the bona fides of the sample.
Brian, what do you have?
It all depends on the condition and the minute, on how well it can be hidden. Because the information I have, I don't want everybody to know about it.
Well, you have a piece of something that could be analyzed. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
And it was from an abduction or an encounter experience?
Yes, very much so. In fact, it's from a hybrid.
Well, that's something certainly we'd be clearly interested in looking at. But, you know, obviously we'd like to have some kind of dialogue in it. And sort of work with you and sort of look into the story as much as we can.
Right,
Brian,
right.
You want to tell the story now or not?
I'd rather now. I'd rather send it to him and have him look it over.
Yep. Well, we have. Okay.
Go on from there.
Well, we have links to where you can contact Bill Chalker. You can also send it to me, and I can send it on to him. I'd like to be in that loop too. That sounds pretty intriguing. Is that okay with you? Why don't you send us an email? Send it as soon as you pull over the truck and get to a computer, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Thanks, Brian. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come back with more of your questions for Bill Chalker here on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the phones with your questions for Bill Chalker, east of the Rockies, Sam in New York. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, gentlemen. I had a question, and I'll take the answer off air. Have you ever heard of like the Aborigines having any experiences with aliens and stuff like that in Australia?
I have worked with a lot of Aborigine communities. I've even had a couple of Aboriginal shaman-type people even ask me to write their biography. And, you know, yes, and the short answer is that, yes, they've had a lot of experiences with UFOs, with what appear to be alien beings, etc. I wouldn't do the disservice with Australian Aborigines to argue that all of their sky being lore is due to aliens in the classic alien abduction tradition, but certainly if you recollect the 2000 Olympics here in Sydney, one of the big features of the opening ceremony was the big one genotype face that rose up out of the middle of the Homebush Arena, which was quite spectacular. That was the face of the primary one genotype being, and that one genotype being, for many people, and even prior to this, had Aboriginal people and also Western abductee type people remark on how close the one genotype face appears to be consistent with the classic grey alien being. You've got your two large eyes and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of aspects to Aboriginal experience here in Australia that seem to intersect with the whole UFO alien abduction tradition.
And is this long-term, way, way back? I know it seems I've seen sort of cave drawings or rock paintings that from Aboriginal people that go way, way back.
Yeah, well, the further you go back, of course, the more and more uncertain these sort of similarities become, and you start to speculate pretty wildly. You get into kind of von Däniken speculation territory, but it's happening even now amongst remote Aboriginal communities. Where I've even had communications with anthropologists who have worked for a decade or two amongst remote Aboriginal communities where UFO sightings and abduction experiences have been quite common.
And have you looked at their DNA?
We're working on it.
I didn't mean to spill any secrets there. West of the Rockies, Mark here in Las Vegas. How you doing, Mark?
Hi, George. I had a question for Bill Chalker. I was watching those tapes of the Mexico City UFO sightings.
Yep.
And it does kind of look like Venus, except there's a formation of military helicopters, and then one of them passes between the cider and the helicopters. Did you see that?
It's been a long time since I've gone down that path and looked at all that information about particularly the Mexico eclipse videos. And I know that there are literally hundreds of videos that have come out of Mexico, and a lot of them associated with Mexico City and the eclipse, etc. I don't particularly recollect that aspect, but of what I did look at the time, they all seem to involve this singular light source, etc., and the directions all seem to be consistent with the locations of where Venus should be.
So your statement, Bill, would be that of the ones you've seen, it seems that the explanation you give sort of covers it, but you're not familiar with all of them.
No, I'm clearly not familiar with all of them. I don't know whether that film that's been described occurred on the day of the eclipse.
Mark, you still there? Mark's gone. First-time caller. Oh, Mark, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you want to follow that up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I was in agreement with him until I saw that one. And they actually slow the tape down there, and they kind of make a circle around the light source. And it does indeed pass in front of a helicopter. So then I thought, no, that can't be a planet.
Right.
Well, but there are hundreds of hours of those tapes. It's a lot to watch.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm only going on what information I had at the time. And I'd be certainly open to other inquiries and other information that might argue an alternate explanation for it. But based on what I looked at the time, it certainly compelled me to the idea that a lot of the videoing that occurred that day appeared to be of Venus, and they are amongst the videos that were being presented as of a UFO over Mexico City on that day.
I think your Hair of the Alien evidence is fantastic. You've done some really good work there.
Well, I hope it continues, because that's only all based on one single case. We've tried this approach to a good number of cases since then, and only a handful have got sort of marginally compelling evidence, and the Peter Currie case seems to be the one that's the most compelling to date, and it's certainly given us the most insights to date, all of which is really still in hypothesis territory, but we're looking at it, and it certainly suggested a lot of interesting avenues of research.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. So you get calls and people give you samples of stuff and you test it or investigate it, and it turns out to be pretty prosaic or mundane?
Yeah. Well, as I suggested earlier, there, because of the time, effort, resources and money and that kind of thing involved, we really need to do a lot of extensive workup before we even get to the stage of going down that research path, because there's so much involved in doing it. And we need to be fairly certain about the authenticity of the sample, the chain of evidence. And one of the issues you have to cover in a lot of detail and with a lot of care is the element of contamination. What has been the journey that sample has undertaken? Has it been handled by one, two, hundreds of people or whatever? Or how has it been preserved? So there's a lot of issues involved. And obviously, if it's been handled by a lot of people, et cetera, it becomes a very difficult and problematical sample.
Sure, you got to do a lot of work before you're willing to pay $10,000 a pop for the DNA test. I guess, yeah.
It's not going to cost that kind of money these days. The techniques, in the whole field of DNA research, has increased exponentially. And if we had the same journey to undertake now, that we could do it now rather than back then, we may have done it a little differently because of so much improvement has occurred in DNA techniques since then, and we're only talking a few years, basically. And so the whole game is evolving and improving at an exponential rate. And so the opportunities are there. And I'm just arguing that a lot of these kind of abduction cases should be looked at in that light. And if there is biological evidence, it should be looked at using DNA techniques, that kind of thing. And that's something that I think American research should be doing. It shouldn't just be us here in Australia doing it as well.
Well, it raises the interesting question of whether or not the improved techniques would have a different result for your hair sample.
Well, that's true, and we have, as I said earlier, I qualified it earlier, we were dealing with a compromised sample at the time, but I think we got a pretty good result out of the limited sample that we had, and modern techniques might give us, I think, given the fact that we did replicate the results in the phase two test, so I think it would have confirmed the same sort of results, but we might be able to look at a lot of different areas. There are techniques now with DNA testing, where we can do almost close to whole genome type testing, or very large profiles of the DNA, all in very rapid sort of shotgun approach DNA type work. And so the techniques are becoming more and more sophisticated, but at the same time, because you can do more with a lot less sample, the complexities and problems with contamination become bigger and bigger. So there are a lot of issues involved in doing this work, and that's why we have to do it very, very carefully.
So could you take a hair sample and analyze it and recreate sort of a version of what the being looked like?
We're a long way from that.
Just wishful thinking.
Yeah, you know, we have the same issue here where we're trying to clone the Tasmanian tiger here. You know, we have various stuffed samples here and bits of hair and bits of skin, etc., but a lot of it's deteriorated and been preserved and, you know, in the traditional ways, and so the DNA has been ultimately compromised in large ways. And the only way that you can do that kind of idea that you're suggesting is to put it all into a host animal, something fairly close, so you won't end up with an original Tasmanian tiger. You'll end up with something that's a bit of a hybrid.
Well, I'd love to see an alien hybrid that's blonde. And
so would I.
We're going to go to the first-time caller line, Phil in Newport Beach. Phil, we don't have a lot of time before the break. You can ask your question, and if need be, we'll come back. Phil,
no
you there?
No worries. Yeah, hey,
okay.
Guys. Hey, George. Hey, Bill. I'm moving to New Zealand here in Halloween, but don't worry, I know Aussies are tougher than Kiwis.
Okay.
But anyway, let me think, where do I start? Oh, wow. The whole contact experience changed my life, my dad's life. And in a way, the whole human race is kind of a hybrid experiment, if I do say so. And how do you think about how the whole contact experience happens, how it's either physical or it's...
Hey, Phil, you got to turn something down there in the background. You're bleeding in some audio to us, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it too much? Okay. Let me move outside. I was thinking about how they possibly, when they're not ready for the experience, they separate the consciousness from the so-called animal body, so the panic doesn't come in.
Phil, Bill, have you heard of cases like that?
Yeah, of course. There are a lot of cases where there is that kind of trauma aspect to it. There's a kind of a blocking off or a separation process goes on. You know, obviously, I'm more comfortable in areas that do with the physical aspects of it, but I work with a lot of people that deal with that kind of aspect where you're getting into the more consciousness aspects of it. And I guess if you want to go the whole gamut of it, there are people that are working in what they refer to as multi-dimensional kind of aspects, you know, some of which falls and spills into what's popularly referred to as the New Age aspects. Those, to me, are a little less compelling and a lot more subjective than, you know, the physical approach. But there are aspects that may have validity and need to be looked at, and a lot of people are looking at that aspect.
Phil, you can continue, but we're going to take a break here. Hang on, and we'll get back to your follow-up question after the break. Stay with us. We're into the home run stretch here with our guest, Bill Chalker, and we'll get back to more of your questions after the break on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Chalker, UFO author and researcher specializing in cases in his native Australia. And we're going back to the phone lines in just a moment. If we get a chance, we'll ask him about Mothman-type cases down under and in his neck of the woods. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We go back to the phones. Phil in Newport Beach, take it away.
Hey, guys. Great music tonight, George. Anyway, I'll let you go after a couple things about the separating the consciousness from the body and how they're not ready for the contact. But from the earlier caller with the Aborigines and their legend of I heard there was a legend of the reptilian race that lives underground that rules over men. And the other thing is, if you could help any other contactees out there and how to deal with what they're experiencing and going through the transformational process of love and everything. Love you guys. Thank you. Meditate, everybody.
Thanks, Phil. Good question, though. What advice do you give to people going through this experience, Bill?
it's a kind of pretty complex sort of situation because, number one, really, you've got to look after the welfare of the people involved, et cetera, and if there's any kind of conflict between, I guess, the detailed kind of research investigation side of it and the welfare of the people involved, well, then, you know, the research investigation side of it takes a back seat and just stops. You know, you've got to really sort that side of it out. And some people who try to explore this have got so much conflicted baggage that it's best for them to sort of stand back and sort out their own lives first, you know, with the appropriate assistance before they start exploring this very complex and confronting area.
Is there such a thing as warding this off? I've heard these cases here in America in particular where people can make it go away.
Well, I know that Dan Dreifel, who is a fairly experienced researcher, published a book on that very theme of trying to prevent alien abduction experiences, and I know there's a lot of mixed results in that area, and I get a lot of conflicting information from a lot of the people that I've worked with over the decades, and some say these things work, some say they don't, and some argue that it's going to happen, it's going to happen, and there's not much you can do about it. That seems pretty pessimistic, but it seems to occur in a lot of cases, but others have tried some of the things that have been described by people like Androffel, and it seems to work.
In so many of the cases that we've heard documented by David Jacobs and John Mack and Bud Hopkins, it seems to follow families generation to generation. Any indication that Mr. Corey's family had any other experiences earlier?
Well, he had experiences as a child, there are, well, it's kind of a personal thing that in his case I don't want to particularly get into.
Okay.
I don't think he'd enjoy me sort of exploring that aspect because we have had a lot of discussions along those lines. But I know that one of the classic cases that I looked at from New Zealand in an area called Gisborne on the East Coast, there was a very complex milieu of abduction cases that occurred with many different people in the Gisborne area back in 1977 to 1978, and some of it's ongoing, and it does seem to be generational in the sense that in one classic case there, one of the best cases there that I've looked at, the daughter of the main person who featured in the 1977 cases, her daughter's having experiences, and it seems her own children, the grandchild of the original abductee, is having experiences, and that's something that's being played out here in Australia and you know, with that family. So it's something that I've been looking into and following.
And it's a really disturbing aspect of the whole thing, for sure. Wildcard Line, Kevin in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, George. How you doing?
Okay.
Out in the field out now, my backyard, right near where Flight 93 went down. Yeah, playing out here in a crop circles. You know what crop circles?
We know about that, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a crop circle out here about the size of a football stadium right now.
What shape?
People walking around down there and looking at things.
And so tell us.
I just picked up three coins down there. One of them says Pachinko on it. And it's got a picture of a crop circle, and I'm standing with the rest of them now. You can see the gentleman wants to talk to you.
I'm not sure I understand this. You're telling me that in the middle of the night people are walking around in a crop circle near where you are?
Yeah, right in Pennsylvania where Flight 93 went down.
And when did this appear?
There's an object there with blinking, flashing green lights on it.
Really? When did it appear?
It's still sitting there. I'm right down next to it, about 5 feet from it.
Well, I don't know if it's actually happening.
This guy wants to talk to you, I think. Here, can we ask him what you want to tell him? I want to know if there are Atlanticus Tanaticus. He's got a coin I gave to George Norris. I mailed it to him myself, but a UFO myself. Yes, yes, yes. I understand you. Yes.
Hey, Kevin, thanks. That was very interesting. I don't know where he was going. Bill, what were you going to say about that?
Well, I was just saying if there was any substance to that story, or really the nature of the story he was implying. You know, I know I have a lot of experience in investigating UFO landing cases where there's been physical traces, and one of the best researchers in that area operates out of the United States, and that's Ted Phillips, and he's looked at you know, literally thousands of those sorts of cases. So if there's anything to these sorts of stories, he's the man to look at them in terms of the U.S. experience anyway.
Ted Phillips is one of my favorite guests. We've had him a couple of times here, a very experienced and credible researcher. I know you've had some similar formations in your part of the world. Used to be called saucer nests, right?
Yeah, well, that the saucer nest name came from the classic case from 1966 at Tully, which I've looked at extensively over the years. And it was even the inspiration for either Doug or Dave, whichever one, who was actually living in Australia at the time. That inspired him to go faking a lot of the crop circles that occurred in England. I'm not saying that he was the sole perpetrator or source behind every crop circle that's occurred, but the original 1966 Tully nest was certainly a very classic example of the unexplained sort of landing sites where a large circular area about 30 feet across was discovered directly in the wake of a UFO rising out of a lagoon area, which was had all sorts of reeds in it, and etc. And there were, it became a media sensation in the day, and the name crop circles arose from that.
Well, Doug and Dave may have been remarkable old barflies, but I don't think they're responsible for all the crop circles that occurred in even their own neck of the woods. Yeah. East of the Rockies, Chris in Houston. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. My question is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. In my personal experience and my encounters, I have seen, and what I've seen and what I've been told leads me to believe that some of the hybridization has been between humans and other animal species, so specifically feline, cetacean, and avian. In other words, not only are some of the entities or people that are in these what we consider aliens actually combinations of human and feline or cetacean or avian, but that also they've introduced into some of us selected bits of DNA, genetic material from these other species, specifically for experimental medical to improve, et cetera. Have you come across anecdotal or physical evidence of anything like that?
I haven't specifically, but when you think about what we're doing with different species, and splicing off pieces of DNA from different species and or even from plants and cross-splicing and that kind of thing, we're doing it. So if it's, in fact, what's happening amongst alien abduction cases, it wouldn't surprise me.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Yeah,
first-time caller, Ann in Florida. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I had an interesting experience when I was a child.
Let's hear it.
My mother and we'd been picked up from the airport someplace in Arkansas, and we were driving on the road. It was a two-lane highway through cornfields, and the guy driving was a member of an auxiliary fire department or something, so he had a two-way radio. And in the distance, we saw this bright light coming through the cornfield, and he braked because he thought it was a tractor or another car coming through the cornfield, and we waited and waited, and when it finally got there, it was very, very bright, moving very, very fast. You know, maybe 6-7 feet off of the ground, and like, you know, like whoosh, just went past. And I remember staring there for a while, and then he tried starting the car. The car had stalled, and or it had just died. And he tried using the radio, and the radio was nothing but static. And when we got back to the house with the people we were visiting, we got back to his house. His wife said, "Why didn't he answer the radio?" And that there had been 2 hours time lapse. He should have been back 2 hours ago. 2 hours, you know, had gone by. And, you know, we didn't remember sitting there for 2 hours or anything.
That sounds like an interesting story to explore. Have you talked to any kind of experienced researchers in the States or near where you live?
No, I haven't. This was in Arkansas, and I really didn't even think it was. I remember he called in the morning. He called some places, and he had friends, I guess, in the military or some kind of base, maybe. I don't know where it would be. I was just a kid, you know. It was in probably 66, 67. Mm. And
even though it occurred a long time ago, I'm sure between George and myself, there'd be people that we could put you in touch with that would certainly like to find out about it.
The military told him that it was a meteor. And I'm thinking, if it was a meteor, how come it didn't catch the corn, which was dry, on fire?
Yeah, it's a pretty low-flying meteor.
I don't know. The more I've heard about meteors and stuff, I'm thinking, why didn't it scorch the car or scorch the ground? And why didn't we feel heat from it? Why didn't it set the cornfield on fire? And how come it was like, you know, 6-7 even feet, like, off the ground?
Well, I think if it was a true meteorite event, the effects would have been a lot more catastrophic. So I doubt that explanation based on what you're saying. But it sounds like an experience that would be well worth looking into, and encourage you to get in contact with it, either George or myself, or some of the local UFO researchers.
And you are welcome to send us an email or something with some contact information, and we'll see what we can do about hooking you up, okay? Thanks. Bill, I wanted to mention, I remember when I was down there in your country, hearing some high strangeness cases. And I mentioned in the tease sort of about Mothman type activity, and remember hearing stories sort of similar to Skinwalker Ranch, the Utah Bigelow Ranch. You've looked into some of these, haven't you?
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting ones for me, and it's an area that I like to specialize in at times as well, is the historical pre-1947 cases. And there was a case I looked into, and it was a story I got from one of the original participants who was 10 years old at the time, and his sister, who was living on a remote property up near Moolumbar on the New South Wales-Queensland border. And back in 1927, their family ran a kind of a dairy farm type thing with some pigs, etc., and that kind of thing as well, and dairy cattle. And for a period of several weeks, they experienced a phenomena that was remarkably prophetic of what was to come in the Ohio Valley during 1966-67 with the Mothman prophecy stuff that was popularized by John Keel. And it had, back in 1927 here in Australia, on this remote property, you had the whole gamut of lights in the sky, a UFO landing, a mark left behind, what appeared to be men in black, strange bird-like creatures that terrorized a number of the people in the area, and cattle and pig mutilations going on, all this happening in a very confined period of time way back in 1927.
And what do you make of that? Come on, you're on the spot. What does it all mean?
Well, it certainly seems that something very strange is going on, and it appeared to be quite alien in nature, and that whatever was involved appeared to be UFO-related and seemed to be interested in our livestock and also the people.
Looking at the bigger picture, when you look at these high strangeness cases, UFOs, mutilations, crop formations, even sometimes poltergeist-type activity, does it all fit together? Is it telling us something?
You know, because it's so high strangeness and they're in the minority, it shouldn't necessarily be the thing that guides us in the way we try to understand the UFO phenomenon. But clearly it often is at the cutting edge. You know, I know when you mentioned poltergeist, I'd been sort of pondering that recently, particularly with the passing of John Keel, because that was one of the things that he liked to get into. One of the classic cases of a car stop case where a UFO hovered over a car and shone a sort of a transparent beam down onto the car and stopped the car. It occurred at a place in Western Australia in 1967, a place called Booyup Brook in Western Australia. And that location was not only the location of a lot of UFO phenomena, it was the location of a classic poltergeist outbreak, one that occurred way back in 1957, and the area was virtually exactly the same. And even at the time, back in 1957, there was UFO phenomena associated with the classic poltergeist outbreak. And this was of the form of falling stones that would drop out of the sky, and it became a major meteor event. So there is that kind of connection going on. Just what all it means, I don't know, but there's certainly very weird high strangeness aspects to this whole subject that we've got to get a real grip on.
Well, tell me, are you uncomfortable or do you stop yourself from even speculating, or at least in public, about the ultimate answers. Are these aliens from other planets? Are they dimensional beings, travelers in time, things of that sort?
I'm never too afraid to speculate, but I always realize that speculation might be repudiated within a week because of the nature of the events that you keep investigating. But to me, the whole UFO phenomenon seems to involve something that appears to exploit a technology that's way beyond us, but it also seems to interact with us at levels that, at least from our point of view, appear to go into the whole strange, high strangeness aspect, the paranormal aspect, the consciousness aspect. They're all valid aspects of the UFO phenomenon, and we've got to be able to be consider all those aspects to come up with a valid answer to the UFO phenomenon. And all our speculations to date have, I think, fallen short. The UFO phenomenon, at the heart of it, seems to be something that's a lot stranger than just ordinary nuts and bolts extraterrestrial explorers. That appears to be part of it, but something else is involved, or that seems to involve things that at a very complex level that go way beyond your average garden variety ET traveler.
Well, not just complex, but nonsensical, things that don't seem to make sense on any level. It's almost like a learning curve, like it just wants to get us out of our thinking patterns, our paradigm.
Yeah, well, the Skinwalker Ranch saga became a little bit more public, etc. I'd already been aware of a lot of the aspects of it, and particularly in the earlier days when I went back into the 60s and 70s with Salisbury book, the Utah UFO Display, all of which was the same area, and your own book. It was like a sense of deja vu to me because I'd been involved with areas like that in Australia where things were played out. Particularly in the 70s, while I was at the University of New England up at Armidale, where we had an area where high strangeness seemed to be the rule of the day. And we were there going down to these locations every weekend, and I spent weeks at a time in the area, and it wasn't just UFOs. It was landings, it was sort of psychic events going on, and some pretty weird phenomena all wrapped up in the same package. And it was difficult to find out what was going on then, and you've obviously had the same problems with the Skinwalker situation as well.
Well, see, Bill, after you write that Chinese UFO book, you can write that one. thanks for being with us. I really can't wait to get back down there and see you sometime.
Okay, be my pleasure.
All right, Bill Chalker. Thanks. Bill Chalker was our guest. Thank you. Thanks also to T.D. Barnes, who was in the first hour. Jason, Gina, Ann, George, Ian, Art. Thank you all. I'll be back next week. My guest will be Chris O'Brien, who's written an unsettling new book called Stalking the Trickster. Until then, good night, everyone.